Hello, I'm Mike Reed. This is 0121, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it's coming to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0121. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we have another visit from Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, who talks about some of the latest news in space exploration, including the discovery of the new planet, Kepler-22b.
All that astronomers have to work with is a beam of light, but that beam of light from very far distances in space has a lot of information contained with it. It can actually put it through a prism and divide that beam of light into different color components, and they can actually see the chemistry of the planet. They can determine also from the variation in that light of how large the planet is, how far away the planet is from its parent star.
Sarah Milstein is the co-author of The Twitter Book. It certainly has grown in popularity, but does everybody need to be on Twitter?
Certainly there's lots and lots of buzz, and there has been for a couple of years now, and I meet people all the time who feel guilty if they're not yet on it. I think guilt is probably a little strong for the situation, but it's valuable for lots and lots of people, or it can be valuable, and we wrote the book to demystify it and make it simple to get a lot out of it.
Stuart Nullman is here with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, eh? And on this edition of Book Banter, humorist Will Ferguson will be dishing up some slices of Canadian pie, along with some other Ferguson favorites. So take off, hosers. It's all coming up on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0121, was Mike Reed, producer and director at Key Media. And you can learn more about Key Media by going to their website at keme.qc.ca. You'll also find the link on the Stuff File page for this show, which is show number 0121. And I thank you very much, Mike, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. And thank the fine folks at Key Media as well. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, having sex in unusual and often public places is not all that new. You may have tried it yourself. But it's doubtful you've got anything on the couple at an amusement park in Poland who were caught joining the water slide high club at the top of one of the park's giant water slides. Now, security cameras caught the whole thing, and angry park attendants met the randy couple with buckets of cold water at the bottom of the slide. The woman was filmed straddling her boyfriend and starting to do the deed right before the pair shot down a bright blue tunnel. Clearly, this is outside the boundaries of park rules, so the couple was escorted straight from their tunnel of love to the park exit without even allowing them to retrieve their clothes. One lifeguard said they were at it for a good 5 minutes before anyone realized what was going on. And now they're famous, as a photo of the couple has been circulating among the European tabloids. You know, I hear a story like that, and all I think about is the logistics of it all. I mean, for starters, at the very least, they both have to have great abdominal and thigh muscles to pull this off. That's all I'm saying. Somebody works out. Anyway, 21-year-old Douglas Shane Southard couldn't have picked a worse spot in his hometown of Hickory, North Carolina, to have a DWI crash. While allegedly driving drunk, our friend Doug slammed his 1989 red Camaro right into the back of the Booze It or Lose It mobile unit that law enforcement had set up as a DWI checkpoint. Officers were inside the unit at the time, but thankfully no one was injured. Shane was transported to hospital with no life-threatening injuries and will be facing all manner of charges. Sometimes you have to work hard to go fishing, and sometimes the fish just come to you. Okay, talk about holding a grudge. In Daly City, California, police say 39-year-old Jesua Tatad became so angry over seeing her ex-husband with another woman, she poured boiling water on him as he slept and then beat him with a baseball bat. Now, even more bizarre, though they were divorced, the couple continued to share a home together. The victim suffered severe burns to 60% of his body. Prosecutors say Tatad waited until her ex was asleep before pouring a full pan of boiling water over his body. As he leapt up in pain, she was waiting with a baseball bat and allegedly clubbed him in the head. Somehow, he managed to escape and flag down a passing security guard outside his home. An ambulance rushed him to San Francisco General Hospital, where he was admitted in critical condition. San Mateo County District Attorney Steve Wagstaff said the victim is unable to speak due to his injuries and added that Mrs. Tatad, or Ms. Tatad, wasn't cooking anything prior to the incident and deliberately boiled the water for the attack. He added that the victim is in pretty bad shape and will survive, but that he's in for, quote, a long, long recovery. Now, Tatad was arrested and charged with several felonies, including assault with a deadly weapon, aggravated mayhem, and torture. Okay, let's back up a bit. They are divorced, but still living together. That alone is aggravated mayhem and torture, don't you think? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Okay, right about now, we need a warm and fuzzy story after that last one. So here goes. A woman in Sussex, England, is giving locals a chance to experience the true meaning of Christmas. And by that, we mean find out firsthand what the first Christmas was like. Fiona Turton will be charging guests $15 a night during the holiday season to spend the night in her donkey's stable. The unusual bed and breakfast features a cozy double straw bed, tea-making facilities, and heating. And just in case you don't want to get too close to that original Christmas, there's also wireless internet and mood lighting. Shepherd costumes and bath towels are available at an additional cost. Fiona and her husband, who are both doctors, intend to donate any money they make to leukemia and lymphoma research. And according to Fiona, she hopes that the idea will help people to, quote, rediscover the true meaning of Christmas. Now, isn't that kind of sweet? God bless us, everyone. Yes. On to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. There have been several news items in the space and exploration world: a new Mars rover, a new discovery by an old Mars rover, and a new planet that perhaps we can call home one day. So once again on the program, we welcome Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy, to talk to us about what's going on in space. He joins us via Skype to Skype communications. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Peter.
Nice to have you back on the show.
Great to be here.
So it's been a busy week. I don't know where to begin. So let's start off with the new planet that was discovered by the Kepler team. Tell us about Kepler 22b, which is not exactly a romantic sounding name, but it'll do.
Yeah, it doesn't have a really nice, catchy name just yet. But it's named after the star that Kepler spacecraft is actually watching, Kepler 22. It's this Kepler is a NASA spacecraft. It's basically a space telescope that's staring at one chunk of the sky. It's actually in the constellation Cygnus, the Swan. Some of your listeners might be aware of it. It's a very bright summertime constellation, also known as the Northern Cross, and it's staring at one chunk of that piece of sky 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it's in its view of this telescope is over 150,000 stars. And what it is it's watching the star light vary over time, so in brightness. So sometimes it drops, sometimes it brightens, and then it drops again. And the cause of the variations in stars, we think, is caused by planets transiting in front of it, sort of eclipsing the star, you can think of it. So as a tiny planet goes in front of the star from our line of view, the starlight drops just a tiny, exquisitely small little bit, and because of the planet going in front of the star. And so we can actually track that with Kepler. Kepler Space Telescope is capable of seeing very, very small variations in light. I mean, it's so small, just, Peter, get this. It's as small as if we imagine the Empire State Building, this huge skyscraper in New York, with all the office lights on. And if we're staring at that from a distance, and you suddenly someone in one office pulls down a shade by, say, half of the window, that change in brightness Kepler would be able to detect. That's equal to how much light is dropping in when a planet transits in front of these stars.
Now, I understand that Kepler has noticed that the light going by every once in a while comes to about, I believe, 290 every 290 Earth days.
That's right. So what's that telling us is that there's a planet that's going in front of the star, orbiting the star once every 290 days. So the orbit, or 1 year on this planet that's orbiting this star, Kepler-22, you know, that orbit is 290 days long. That's like, you know, for us here, Earth's one orbit around our sun is 365 days.
Okay. So what I'd like to know, though, what I'm curious, because one of the things I heard, and I mentioned earlier in the introduction, that, you know, one of the, you know, facetiously, one place that we could eventually call home, it's supposed to be one of these so-called Goldilocks planets. In other words, it's not too hot, it's not too cold. They figure it's approximately 72 degrees Fahrenheit or 22 degrees Celsius on the surface. How would they know that?
And this is really the amazing. All of that information is really contained within the beam of light. You know, astronomy is a funny science. It's not like your traditional biological science where, you know, a scientist can go into a swamp and scoop out, you know, with their Petri dish something from the swamp and put it under the microscope and then poke it and prod it. All that astronomers have to work with is a beam of light. So, but that beam of light from very far distances in space has a lot of information contained with it. It can actually put it through a prism and divide that beam of light into different color components, and they can actually see, you know, the chemistry of the planet. They can determine also from the variation in that light, okay, the brightness of the light, of how large the planet is, how far away the planet is from its parent star. And when you mentioned Goldilocks, and that term is being used a lot lately in exoplanet research, that's sort of one of the holy grails, because the Goldilocks zone is where water can exist in liquid form. So if, you know, it's not too hot and it's not too cold, basically. And if you look here in our solar system, we have the Earth within the Goldilocks zone. And if you look a little bit farther away from Earth, you have Mars, which is too cold. And you look a little closer to the sun from the Earth, you have Venus, which is too hot. So Earth just happens to be in the right place where water can exist in liquid form. And why that's important is that we think water is a key ingredient for finding life. That's a key ingredient in life, in the makeup of life. To have water, stable, large pools or oceans of water, is one of the conditions we think is necessary for life to exist. So this planet,
or at least life as we know it, because we are mostly water.
Exactly, yeah. That's right. And our planet is really a watery planet. And this new planet, Kepler-22b, is snap dab right in the middle of this Goldilocks zone. So we know the size of the planet is fairly, you know, small. It's Earth-like. You know, it's about 2.5 times larger than the Earth, but it means that it's rocky, has a rocky surface like the Earth, and because it's located in the Goldilocks zone, we think that the conditions on this planet would be suitable for water to exist. Okay. And we're finding, you know, I mean, we've found hundreds of planets so far. Most of them tend to be Jupiter size, very large, too close to their parent sun, so you have scorchingly hot temperatures. where you can't have life, or it's far away from the parent sun, so it's extremely cold. This is exciting because this is the first planet that's kind of the size of the Earth, has a rocky surface, isn't the gas giant. It's rocky, and it may have water. It could be capable of having water on it. So okay, maybe it's a future vacation destination,
okay.
Peter.
Okay. well, we have just a few more minutes to talk about the two other items. One of them being the Mars rover that was just sent up. That was Curiosity, which will land on the red planet in August of 2012. Correct.
That's right. This is a really neat rover. This is a mega rover. It's about the size of a compact car, weighs about 2,000 pounds. It's dubbed Curiosity, six wheels, and it's on a 354 million mile trip to Mars, launched on November 26. It'll take about 9 months to get there. And it's different from the other previous rovers, not just with the size, but its capability. It's outfitted with a suite of 10 really sophisticated science experiments that are designed to look for to see if the environment on Mars is suitable for life, and it could even find evidence of life. And that's the first time we'll be able to do that.
Okay, quick question before we get to the last piece of news, which is kind of getting lost in the shuffle because everyone's talking about the new planet and the new rover. But this rover, what is its lifespan supposed to be? And based on what we've learned by the two previous rovers that are up there that have long exceeded their lifespan, one of them is still working. Is it possible that this new rover could last a lot longer than scientists predict it will?
Definitely. I think so. Engineers working on Mars missions have really learned a lot from the previous three rovers that we've sent there. And this is very different, the Curiosity, because it's not using solar energy anymore. It doesn't have those iconic solar panels that Spirit and Opportunity rovers had. It has an onboard radioisotope power generator. It uses plutonium, a little chunk of plutonium that's highly radioactive. It produces electricity, 100 watts, day and night. So this rover is going to have its own power source. It's independent of the sun and the surrounding environment. So it can work day and night. And right now they expect it to work for one Martian year, which is equal to two Earth years. And I've spoken with the lead engineer, and he says if everything goes well, and it stays healthy, it could last for up to a decade.
Okay. And finally, we have just about a minute or so. I mentioned one of those older rovers. I believe it was Opportunity.
That's right.
Opportunity has uncovered mineral deposits on the red planet, which, again, goes back to the idea that long ago water flowed.
That's it. I mean, right now, this is hot new breaking news that Opportunity, the last remaining rover on Mars, has found what scientists are calling bulletproof evidence that liquid water once existed on the red planet. And this means that it bolsters the idea that it had a potentially habitable conditions. It found basically a vein of gypsum, which is a mineral that forms only in the presence of liquid water. And this, it's not very big. It's about as wide as your thumb, and it's about 18 inches long. But it was found right in the path of the rover. It was going to roll right over it, and it found it right there, sticking out of the sand dunes. And so it's very exciting because this is probably the strongest evidence that there was a habitable environment on Mars in the distant past.
Fascinating stuff indeed, as always. And very quickly, as I mentioned, Opportunity was launched when? How long was it supposed to last, and how long has it passed its life?
Well, it landed on Mars in early January of 2004, and it was slated to, its warranty was only for 3 months. And look at now, we're in 2011, end of 2011, and still chugging along.
Amazing stuff. People can always find your website, which is thenightskyguide.com. And what are some of the other things you're doing very quickly?
I'm also a writer for National Geographic News, so people can stay up to date on the latest breaking news in astronomy and space science. And they can also find me on Facebook under The Night Sky Guy, where I give breaking news, and my Twitter account, The Night Sky Guy. You can sign up and get up to date on what's happening in the night sky and in space science.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Clear skies.
Andrew Vizekas, the Night Sky Guy. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. And, of course, you can find a link by going to my website at thestufffile.com. Just go to the corresponding program number for this show, which is show number 0121. Go to the What's On page and you'll find all the information.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we will have a chat with the co-author of the Twitter book and another edition of Book Banter. Stuart Nullman will be along. Plus, there is, of course, an idiot of the day. Oh, and a quick programming note. Just a reminder that we are in the holiday period right now, and next week, the Stuff File Christmas show, the Meshach and Malik Christmas show, my two little Rugrat nephews, will be on the program once again. So it's a perennial show. It's a traditional favorite if you like the little kitties and also some of the odd things that they like to hear, as kids are wont to do. You'll enjoy the Stuff File program's Meshach and Malik Christmas show, which is next week. And speaking of the holidays, it is the time of the year. Mistletoe occupies a special place in many Christmas revelers' home. But in the wild, mistletoe is a parasitic plant that creates a leafy ball in the tops of trees. For centuries, the challenge was basically how to get it down. Now, Shannon Wurst, who sells mistletoe at Big John's in Buckhead, Georgia, says, "Tradition has it that you would shoot it out of the tree with a shotgun. At least that's what my grandparents always used to do." So we assume that's the logic that Richard Robinson apparently applied when he was spotted with a shotgun near North DeKalb Mall. According to North DeKalb Police spokeswoman Mecca Parrish, Robinson was firing into the trees in an attempt to get mistletoe out of the tree to decorate his home for Christmas. Now, Robinson was arrested on charges of illegally discharging a weapon and reckless conduct, and police say in the report that he does this every year, but never in the mall parking lot. The suspect was surprised that he was getting arrested. He didn't think he was doing anything wrong. So remember, friends, mistletoe, shotguns, and the mall don't mix. There you go. And it seems even thieves have the holiday spirit this year. Pittsburgh police are looking for a burglar who smashed into the front door of a liquor store and made off with some free booze. The interesting thing was his booze of choice. The crook only stole two bottles of alcoholic eggnog. The Christmas caper was caught on surveillance tape, and police are working to identify the man who is clearly now on Santa's naughty list. Okay, this story comes to us from our good friend Bob Welsh at WDEV in Waterbury, Vermont. How you doing there, Bob? A New Jersey woman who police say injected a young man's penis with silicone, resulting in his death, has been charged with manslaughter. The Essex County Prosecutor's Office said the 34-year-old woman, Cassia Riviera, gave 22-year-old Justin Street the injection back on May the 5th. He died the next day. His death has now been ruled a homicide following an investigation and a medical examiner's determination that Street died of silicone embolism. Riviera also faces charges for the unauthorized practice of medicine. She was only arrested a week ago and is now being held on $75,000 bail. I'd like to know exactly what kind of medicine she was supposedly practicing. And hey, I'm just looking for a motive here. I don't know about you, but I'm thinking most guys who are hearing this are probably hoping that she gets a stiff sentence. Anyway, it certainly wasn't your usual parent-teacher conference. In South France, a group of parents have taken a school principal and several teachers hostage. Apparently, the angry parents want one of the teachers fired. Christophe Plains, one of the parents, said, "We were very worried that the pupils were falling behind in school. We think our children are in danger. That's why we have decided to hold the headmistress and a couple of teachers hostage. We want things to change." The 15 adults occupy the school and are holding several people hostage, and they say that they want the teacher in charge of their 9-year-old children to be fired. The headmistress admitted relations with the teacher, who is in his first year of teaching, have been difficult. The parental mob say that they were aware they risk legal action, but insist their children are being, quote, held hostage or have been held hostage for several months. Local education authorities have agreed to transfer the teacher to another school, but as of press time, the parents were holding out for written documentation. And here's the most amazing part. Police visited the school to assess the situation, but did not intervene. Let me repeat that. Did not intervene. Excuse me, people holding hostages here? Perhaps you might want to, help, or I don't know, free them? Wow. Call me harsh, but I would be arresting all those parents and also expelling their little priceless angels out of the school, too. But that's just me. Even during the holiday season, I feel this way. Anyway, in Naples, Florida, 31-year-old Danielle Ashley was arrested after allegedly trying to walk out of a grocery store with all the makings of a romantic candlelight dinner stuffed down his pants. Employees of the supermarket saw him try to make off with 4 steaks and some candles. Ashley tried to run off after losing the steaks and candles, but was chased down by employees and held for police. Yes, is that a candle in your pants, or are you just happy to see us? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, factory worker Bill Hyatt, who was fired in 2009 by North Georgia plastics company Plyatt Corporation, filed a lawsuit in August alleging illegal religious discrimination. Wait for it. Plyatt, now called Barry Plastics, required its employees to wear stickers indicating the number of consecutive accident-free days, and March 12, 2009 was the 666th day. You see where this is going, don't you? When Hyatt refused to wear the Mark of the Beast, 666, embracing that number he thought would condemn him to hell, he was suspended and then fired. You know, he might actually have a case here. I don't know. But anyway, we'll see what happens. And certainly we'll have no trouble taking the oath in court. So help him God. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Twitter is not just for talking and idle chatter. It is quickly becoming an indispensable communication tool for businesses, nonprofits, celebrities, and people around the globe. Sarah Milstein is one of the co-authors of The Twitter Book, and she joins us now on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us. I think back to when people first started getting websites, people first started going online. It was a situation where people said, I got to get a website, I got to get a web page, but had no idea what it was or what to do with it or how to use it. Are we there now with Twitter?
Yeah, certainly there's lots and lots of buzz, and there has been for a couple of years now, and I meet people all the time who feel guilty if they're not yet on it. I think guilt is probably a little strong for the situation, but it's valuable for lots and lots of people, or it can be valuable. And we wrote the book to demystify it and make it simple to get a lot out of it.
Are there people, let's start off from the negative point of view, are there people who shouldn't be on Twitter?
Well, it's not for everybody. You know, either people find it doesn't fit into their lives or they don't like the kind of information flow or what have you, and that's fine. It doesn't have to be 100% of the population using it for it to be valuable for many, many people.
Well, it's interesting because you bring up the idea of information flow, and I guess one of the negative things people say when they talk about things like Twitter and even Facebook is that I don't really care what someone ate this morning, but just because people put that on their Twitter feed doesn't mean you have to, correct?
Right, and I would say a couple things about that. First of all, sometimes what somebody ate for breakfast is a little valuable piece of information, in the sense that if it's somebody you care about, getting a little snapshot of their day can make you feel more connected to them in a very lightweight way. You don't have to respond. You don't yourself, as you say, have to post information about what you ate for breakfast. But just those little day-to-day snippets can actually be very powerful, particularly over time. So I wouldn't poo-poo those, but you also don't have to go that route. Many people use Twitter mostly for sharing links to things that they're reading or watching or listening to, or for commenting on those things, and that's a great use as well.
Okay, so from a business aspect, let's talk about the advantages of using Twitter.
Yeah, sure. Lots of businesses are finding Twitter great for connecting with customers, for providing customer service, for finding new folks to work with. It can be good for all kinds of things, but the big thing to note as a business is that unless you're a really big brand where everybody already knows and particularly likes you, what you probably want to do is use Twitter to connect with people who are interested in things your business covers. So if you're a bike shop, rather than tweeting about your shop all the time, you might tweet about local races, you might tweet links to stories about equipment and technique and things like that. And about 80% of the time, tweet links to other people's stuff. And then 20% of the time, you can talk about yourself, a sale you're having, a workshop that's going on at your store, things like that.
Okay, is it a good idea to have more than one Twitter account? And for that, I mean, if you're in a business situation, should you have a business Twitter account and a personal one?
It really depends a lot on your relationship with your business and what you're trying to do with your various accounts. I've seen all kinds of approaches work successfully, but I think it's best to start with your goal. What are you trying to do? Are you trying to connect with the same kind of people and share the same kind of information across your personal life, your professional life, different factors of your professional life? If not, then you might think about separate accounts. That's a lot, can be a lot to manage. But it can work, and you can also retweet yourself, your own accounts, when you're trying to share the same kinds of information with different groups of people.
Well, let's talk about the book, the Twitter book, which is now in its second edition. Who was the primary audience you were looking for when you wrote this book with your co-author, Tim O'Reilly?
When we wrote the book in 2009, originally, we had both been on Twitter since the beginning, and we're just getting lots of questions from people who had heard about it and were trying to figure out how to use it. So we really aimed it, the first half of the book in particular is for beginners, and then the second half is taking you to sort of a power user status with a chapter for businesses in particular.
And what are some of the biggest gaps or pitfalls people have walked into when they're on Twitter? What should you do and what should you never do?
Well, one thing to remember on Twitter is that you have to be interesting or people aren't going to follow you. So unlike email, you can't just send stuff out in a blast and expect it to hit people's inboxes. They have to choose to pay attention to you. So you have to be interesting. And that's true on all levels. You want to be interesting when you're talking about your breakfast, and you want to be interesting when you're sharing a link to a radio story. I think the biggest to-do is before you hit the tweet button, which is kind of the send button, think about whether there's a way to make your tweet more interesting and more valuable for your followers. And when you do that, it also means that if you step back, it kind of helps you take some more care and not send things that are inflammatory, things that you wouldn't want to exist associated with you in perpetuity, as tweets will. Gives you a little bit of perspective on what's good to share. And I think just keeping that in mind, how can I be more interesting, can both create a lot of benefits and save you from a lot of trouble.
Also, I'm assuming you don't have to take everything so personal, and by that I mean just because you follow someone doesn't mean they necessarily have to follow you.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. We are firm believers that one of the huge benefits of Twitter is that it's what geeks call asymmetric. You don't have to follow each other. So you can tweet your heart out about things that you care about, and anybody who likes the things you're tweeting about can follow you. But you don't have to follow them back if it happens that they're not tweeting about things you're interested in. That's just fine. And it can be a little awkward at first kind of figuring that out, because it doesn't mirror exactly the way we behave in real life. Like at a party, you would expect to pay attention to each other if you were face-to-face. But this is a different medium, and it allows for some different dynamics. And if you followed everybody who followed you, in most cases, you wouldn't actually be following them because you wouldn't be able to read everything that they're posting. It doesn't become meaningful at that point. So we recommend paying attention to the people you want to pay attention to.
Which brings me to the amount of people that you may be following. Do you, for instance, in your personal account, every once in a while, go what I like to call Twitter pruning?
Occasionally. I certainly have unfollowed people over time. I take a lot of care in who I follow because I do like to be able to pay attention for the most part. And sometimes I unfollow people because it just turns out that we're not interested in the same stuff, or they use a tone that doesn't work for me. But, I get unfollowed, I think, more than I follow, and I try not to worry about it too much.
And again, for businesses, is it, again, important to follow people? You know, sometimes you'll get someone who is following you and or just about to follow you, and you look at theirs and you see that their ratio of following to followers is way off one way or the other, or a very high or very low number of tweets. Does that say something about someone or some entity?
Yeah. So there's two parts to your question there. You asked about businesses, and then you asked about sort of when you analyze your followers. So if you're a business, I do recommend basically following everybody who follows you, unlike personal accounts, because it allows for a customer service relationship, and it also shows a certain kind of respect in a business context that is different from a personal context and I think can be important. But as you say, you could take a look at accounts and see that they seem kind of off because they are not... they're following thousands of people, but nobody's following them. That particular setup is usually a sign of somebody who's a spammer. Those are good to stay away from. But a lot of people, may be following folks and don't have any tweets or have very few tweets. And that's perfectly legit because a majority of people on Twitter actually lurk and don't post. And that's fine. That's actually a good way to get some value out of Twitter is you can just read. You don't ever have to post. And it could still be great.
This is the second edition of the book. Do you find that Twitter is something that is quickly evolving, quickly changing?
What tends to change on Twitter are the social norms, the way people use it rather than the service itself. The service itself, I would say, is more evolving than changing rapidly. It's intended to be a simple service that doesn't change a lot. But people come up with new ways to use it all the time, and one of the big things we did in updating the book was to reflect the new ways that people are using Twitter and some of the subtleties to interaction that do tend to change fairly quickly.
In your estimation, how has Twitter enhanced certain things that you do on a regular basis? Like, for instance, for me, I find it interesting to read Twitter or send tweets if I'm watching a football game or an award show, and I'm thinking back to, gosh, what was it like before I did this?
Yeah, and that's such a great experience, right? To share something live with a whole bunch of other people as it's happening. That's one of the things that Twitter is really unusual for and wonderful. And I agree with you. It kind of makes you think, why did we do this alone before? Because it's something you can now share with as many people as you want while it's happening, and it can be a really fun experience.
The book is called The Twitter Book. It's a second edition. It's written by Tim O'Reilly and Sarah Milstein. And Sarah, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure.
Sarah Milstein, co-author of The Twitter Book. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0121, and you'll find links to Sarah's website and also links to Amazon.com where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Imagine you're at work and you see a colleague slumped over in her chair. You discover she's not breathing, and you suspect she's had a heart attack. A woman in Ohio recently found herself in this situation, and thinking quickly, started CPR. She did what she was supposed to do, but what reportedly happened next is shocking. According to a local TV report, the woman was told to stop CPR by a boss because she could be, and I quote, held liable if something goes wrong. The woman died. Let's be fair. We're hearing too many disturbing stories these days about how the fear of being sued is changing the way people behave in America. It's gotten so bad that most states have enacted what are called Good Samaritan laws. These laws protect people from being sued when they rush to the aid of someone in need. And I mention them now because we need to make sure that the fear of being sued is never listed as a cause of death. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
Once again, we're just flipping pages. Here's Stuart Nauman.
Well, thank you, Peter. I'm flipping flapjacks, actually. Why am I saying that?
Why are you saying that?
Well, guess what goes well with flapjacks?
Well, you're asking the wrong guy, because the typical answer as a Canadian would be maple syrup, although I use molasses, so.
Well, the first answer was right.
Okay.
Maple syrup, a Canadian product.
Yes, yes.
Because in this edition of Book Banter, we're going Canadian.
Ah!
A little Canadian pie, to be exact.
Mmm.
Now, although few would like to admit it, Peter, comedians, and especially humorists, not only have the ability to make their audiences laugh, but somehow manage to effectively have their finger on the pulse of their native countries. Through their spoken or printed word, these mirthmakers can give pointed, sensible commentary on what makes their respective homelands work, or what their weak spots are, and they can touch a nerve just as well as any hard news pundit, columnist, or commentator. For example, look at Will Rogers, Mark Twain, P.G. O'Rourke, or Stephen Leacock, who gained solid reputations as both humorists and social commentators. And you can add Canadian humorist Will Ferguson to that impressive list. This prolific writer and author has won the prestigious Leacock Medal for Humor 3 times, and when you read his latest book, Canadian Pie, you can readily understand that those 3 awards were very well earned. This book is essentially a best-of collection of some of Ferguson's best pieces that were written for various publications and broadcasts. And the general impression that you get is that Will Ferguson not only has a sharp, self-deprecating sense of humor that can grab and hold your attention, but he has a vast knowledge and understanding of Canada and what it's like to be a Canadian. And here's some examples that I like from this book. First of all, he writes about the trials and tribulations of going on a cross-Canada book promotional tour and how he harassed a publicist on one stop to manually pick out each and every blueberry from a blueberry muffin that he ordered. How's that? Or one of Ferguson's earliest memories of Toronto, center of the universe. Well, actually, he was working as a quote-unquote space cadet at the CN Tower's Tour of the Universe back in the mid-80s. They don't have that ride anymore.
No.
Also, how his acclaimed bestseller about the Prime Ministers of Canada, it was called Boneheads and Bastards, was met with a sneer from former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, but with high praise from one of Chrétien's aides. And finally, his lively account of how he developed one of the draft scenarios for the closing ceremonies of the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics, which would have involved, listen to this, William Shatner, Seth Rogen, Martin Short, Dan Aykroyd, Michael J. Fox, Mike Myers, Eugene Levy, and Pamela Anderson. Yes, but the that scenario ended up as a essay in the program book for the closing ceremonies.
Now, I'm just curious, would an American audience get anything or understand what he's writing about?
Well, I think so, actually. But you know what? Even if an American audience would like to a little bit know about what's Canadian, you know, these days, Will Ferguson really writes very clearly and very concisely about, you know, what makes Canada very popular, what makes it unusual, what makes it unique, but not that it doesn't take it that seriously. It's a lot of you know, self-deprecating and a lot of sharp humor involved in that. So you could laugh at, you could, you know, we as Canadians could laugh at it, and Americans could laugh at it as well in good spirits, I might add.
Excellent. So what other types of books do you recommend in this vein?
Well, if you want to know about Canadian comedians in comedy, I recommend this book published in 1997 and maybe out of print, but check it out. It's called Stand and Deliver by Andrew Clark, which is a history of Canadian humor and Canadian comedians like Wayne and Schuster, Jim Carrey, Mike Myers, Lorne Michaels. Excellent book. I think it's one of the best that's written about that subject. And also, if you like Canadian pie, you want to read a little bit more by Will Ferguson, check out Boneheads and Bastards. And also, he wrote a book that was one of his Leacock Awards and was a very big bestseller. It's called How to Be a Canadian. And don't take it too seriously. It's a lot of fun, let me tell you.
And this week's book is?
It's called Canadian Pie by Will Ferguson, published by Viking Canada. And it's only $32 Canadian.
$32 Canadian. And how can people find you if they want to find you in case, you know, they're looking?
Well, if you're in the United States or Canada and you want to read about this review or any other review, you can just check me out at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
Well, good day, Peter, eh?
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're coming around the clubhouse turn on this edition of the Stuff File program. We still have an idiot of the day to get to, but I've got a couple more Stuff File news stories to share with you before we wrap things up. Now, there may be nothing more surreal than having a career in law enforcement so distinguished that they name a prison after you and then becoming an inmate in that very prison. Can't make this stuff up, I promise. In Denver, 68-year-old former Arapaho County Sheriff Patrick J. Sullivan Jr. has been arrested on suspicion of trafficking methamphetamine. Sullivan was elected Arapaho County Sheriff for 19 years until retiring in 2002. He then went on to become Director of Safety and Security at Cherry Creek Schools. He was a nationally regarded law enforcement figure, and President Bill Clinton named Sullivan in 1995 to the National Commission on Crime Prevention and Control. Now, according to a 1995 White House news release, Sullivan was a consultant to U.S. House Subcommittee on Crime and served on two advisory councils affiliated with the Department of Justice. In 2001, the National Sheriff's Association named him Sheriff of the Year. And in 2002, the National Association of School Resource Officers also gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award. The ultimate honor for his years of service came when the Arapahoe County Jail was renamed the Patrick J. Sullivan Jr. Detention Facility. Now, current Arapahoe County Sheriff Grayson Robinson says the allegations of criminal behavior involving Pat Sullivan are extraordinarily disturbing. While the arrest of the former sheriff is very troubling, no one, and particularly a former peace officer, is above the law. This is the most shocking thing I've ever been involved with. Now, according to court documents, several informants provided information to law enforcement connecting Sullivan to the distribution and use of methamphetamine. As part of the investigation, authorities say Sullivan agreed to meet a male informant and provide the man drugs in exchange for sex. That's when investigators and members of the South Metro Drug Task Force arrested Sullivan. Ironically, he's now being held at the very prison that was named after him. Nice going, pal. Now I'm hoping I can just get a bank named after me. Do you often receive those unwanted sex-related ads as junk mail? Then this story ought to freak you out. In Stafford, Virginia, the family of Paula Case is having a very tough time. Paula died over 2 years ago, but her adult children have been hammered by a barrage of emails from their dead mother's account. Everything from male enhancement, work at home, and cheap Viagra, all seeming to come from their dead mother, and each a reminder of the pain of losing her. It seems Paula's Yahoo account was hacked, and daughter Cassie Woods says she has called Yahoo and asked the company to close the account. Cassie's husband Jared said it was one of those endless nightmares of push this number and push this number and push that number. Finally, someone from Yahoo told them they needed Paula Chase's death certificate, which they're still trying to get. Ironically, through a Google search, they were able to find Paula's obituary and see that she's listed in the Social Security Death Index. Apparently, this is not good enough for the folks at Yahoo. Maybe they're just mad the family used Google. Cassie says of her late mom, she was a Christian lady, and to see male enhancement in an email from her, it's kind of devastating. Yeah, I understand. And once again, the folks at Yahoo live up to their name. Nice corporate image, guys. Nice corporate image. Almost made them the idiots of the day, but they're not. That's coming later. So, how does an extortionist or kidnapper safely collect the money that has been dropped off for him? In July, police staked out a vacant lot in Coleraine Township, Ohio, after leaving the $22,000 ordered by alleged extortionist Frank Pence. They waited for an hour, but Pence failed to show up. Then one officer noticed the money slowly moving across the field and finally caught up to Pence, who was pulling a very, very, very long, partially concealed rope from a location a distance from the drop site. Okay, another person who's going to jail, but you know what? You got to give him something for style points. That's all I'm saying. Now, boys and girls, time you've been waiting for. It is, once again, the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
Two men, one of them naked, was arrested for allegedly stealing a boat from a covered dock on Lake Botts in Pearson, Florida. 28-year-old Daryl Horn and 27-year-old Matthew Schreider now face charges of armed burglary, grand theft, and resisting an officer after being accosted by police. At one point during the confrontation with police, Horn reportedly started to curse at the deputies and take off his clothes. He then dove into the lake and swam in the opposite direction, cursing and making hand gestures as he went. Horn, still naked, was eventually found in a heavily wooded area along the shore of the lake and put in the back of the patrol car with Schreider. Horn repeatedly kicked Schreider, making the car rock while Schreider yelled at him to stop. At that point, a deputy, armed with a taser, opened the door, at which time Horn told him, "Taser me! Taser me, bro!" As Horn prepared to kick Schreider again, the deputy was more than happy to appease his wishes and tased him. After that, Mr. Horn was extremely cooperative and obeyed orders. He later apologized to the deputy and thanked him for tasering him. Seriously. Wow. Why would someone steal a boat, insult the cops, get naked, swim away, beat up on his friend in the back of a squad car, and then ask to be tased? One reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0121. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and stuff again is spelled S-T-U-P-H. At the website, you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0121. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.